Are you feeling it? The quarantine fatigue?
We're now going to have to keep doing some amount of social distancing for months, if not years. And I think now is the time to start thinking about how to do this in a sustainable way.
I'm Shamitha Basu, in for Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway, for Thursday, May 28th, how you can begin to socialize at a safe distance. Also on the show, for some, the color of your skin dictates where you can and can't spend your time freely.
So when we're talking about predominantly white spaces, there's some idea that white people get to police who is present, regardless of whether or not they own that space or have any inherent right to control who enters that space.
Then we'll speak with comedian Tawny Newsome about preparing to be a pilot on Netflix's new sitcom, Space Force.
I started scoping out and looking for Black women especially who are officers in different branches of the military. I started looking for Black women pilots. I mean, that's kind of the definition of why representation matters, right? If you can see it, then you can imagine yourself doing it.
But first, how long can we stay at home? Most of us have been following stay-at-home orders for weeks now, and, well, it is starting to take a toll. As the weather warms up and people increasingly feel the mental and emotional strain of isolation, quarantine fatigue is a part of our new reality. And the need for social connection with friends and family is becoming increasingly important. We asked you, our listeners, how quarantine fatigue is affecting you.
This is Michelle from Dallas, Texas. I am absolutely feeling quarantine fatigue. I don't know what information to trust, what's safe, where I can go, and what I can do. I have met with some small groups of friends that I know where they've been and what they've been up to pretty much, worn masks whenever I go out, and hope that we're taking all the right precautions, keep washing my hands. The best we can do is try to do the best for each other and hope that it works out.
I'm Richard Bell. I'm calling from Little Rock, Arkansas. The way I'm dealing with quarantine fatigue is that I sit in my garage looking out at all the traffic going up and down the street. And I try to get out here every day for at least an hour just to take in the fresh air, look at the birds, and contemplate what the new normal will be.
This is Nancy from Berkeley, and I am definitely feeling quarantine fatigue. Fortunately, I live in a nice area with nice weather and nice places to hike, so I've been doing two things. One is I've never gotten so much use out of my backyard, which is big enough to meet with one or two friends at a time and sit at a distance. And the other is going distance birding with a couple of friends. We stay 6 feet apart, we pick wide trails, and we get up into the hills and out into nature.
Hi, Rich from San Jose, California. We are spending a little time with some friends. Most of our friends feel the same way about the coronavirus, taking it seriously. Not getting too crazy about it, but definitely taking it seriously. We've had some friends over to the house for a pool party, but, you know, only a handful of people. Just trying to be conscientious of the potential downfalls. Other than that, you know, just trying to live life as normally as possible.
Hi, this is Andrea from Riverdale, New York. For the first 6 weeks, we did not meet up with other people, but about 2 weeks ago, we had friends over in our backyard. They were about 10 feet away from us, and they were sitting on a blanket, and we were sitting on a table, and it was just so wonderful to be able to spend time with people that we care about.
This quarantine is getting old, but I'm not giving up the scientist guidelines. Now that I've got 9 masks and plenty of toilet paper, I'm okay. Plus, I just found out what my real hair color is. This is Barbara in San Jose.
Hi, this is Kristen from Ridgewood, New York. I'm having a really hard time with quarantine fatigue and wanting to open our circle up to grandparents to see our kids. But I'm feeling so guilty on both sides, and I feel guilty if grandparents don't get to see the kids enough and I'm missing them, and I'm also feeling horrible if we were to ever get anyone in our family sick.
It's something just about everyone is grappling with right now. For more on navigating the risks of seeing friends and family, I spoke with Julia Marcus, an infectious disease epidemiologist and an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School. She recently wrote a piece published in The Atlantic on quarantine fatigue. And Christina Cotterucci, a writer for Slate magazine. She's written about her decision to form a quarantine bubble with people outside of her household. And Julia says it's no surprise that this fatigue is setting in now.
In early March, when we started this whole staying at home thing, we had all kind of hoped that it would be a few weeks and then we'd be back to our lives as they were before COVID came along. But now we're several months into this, and it's become very clear that while we really needed to be staying home for those few months, and it had an enormous impact that was really necessary, we're now going to have to keep doing some amount of social distancing for months, if not years. And so I think now is the time to start thinking about how to do this in a sustainable way.
Yeah, and you argue that this sort of all or nothing approach to quarantine might not really be ideal.
That's right. If we think about this with the analogy of abstinence-only messaging, what we're being asked to abstain from right now is social contact. And I think that's doable for many people for a short period of time, but I think we can also all agree that it's not feasible for people to sustain no social contact for a really extended period of time. And sometimes there are inadvertent consequences of abstinence-only messaging. And we see that in the context of, let's say, telling teens not to have any sex. Some ultimately will. And if we don't give them strategies to reduce risk if they do choose to have sex, then we've missed an opportunity. And that's why we sometimes see worse health outcomes with abstinence-only messaging. And the same may happen here.
So, Christina, you wrote about how you decided to form a quarantine bubble with some of your friends who aren't in the same household. Tell us how the bubble works and what are the rules?
So the general concept of forming a quarantine bubble is very similar to the idea of just expanding your household to include more people. So it's a closed circle of people. In my bubble, it's three different households of two people each. And we've all agreed that we're going to have contact with each other, go to each other's houses, interact as closely as we would with a family member, but not have interactions with people outside the house. So essentially, we've expanded our quarantine unit to be slightly larger. And for me, the impetus was just that I was feeling incredibly isolated. You know, my wife and I don't live in a big house. We don't have a backyard. And like a lot of people, you know, we were feeling really lonely, cut off from our community, which is really important to us. And we decided that the risk of increasing our family unit by four other people would be marginal if we limited our contact outside of that bubble. Mm-hmm. So over the course of a couple weeks, we had discussions with these two other households of friends of ours and decided we're all going to take extremely conservative precautions outside of our bubble, you know, wearing masks, not seeing anybody else at a distance closer than 6 to 10 feet. But with each other, you know, we'll interact as we would inside our own household. So having dinners together, hanging out together. And it has given us a little bit of a sense of normalcy in this incredibly abnormal time.
Julia, Christina there's talking about sort of assessing the risks involved. And it seems there could be a trade-off here between the mental health costs of staying isolated and the public health costs of going outside or meeting up with friends and family. How can people navigate that balance in a responsible way?
I think what we want to do is help people see these options, like what Christina is describing, where you expand your bubble to include another household and you do it very carefully and with a lot of good communication around risk. That's a lower risk option for social contact than, you know, what we may have done previously, which is, let's say, have multiple dinner parties a week with different families. That becomes much higher risk. And if there is a real need for social contact, like what Christina just described, then that strategy of the double bubble, which is what some Canadian provinces and New Zealand are calling it, becomes a harm reduction strategy where it accepts that, okay, somebody might need to have social contact and here's a lower risk way to do it than a situation like a crowded house party that could potentially become a super spreader event. And that's really what we want to avoid. So it's not zero risk because, you know, every new social contact is going to increase risk, but it's definitely lower risk than some other alternatives that people may be considering right now.
And I'm glad that you mentioned the concept of harm reduction, Julia, because I've also been thinking about what happens if our quarantine has to last for 12 to 18 more months, or there's another spike in coronavirus cases and we have to lock down again. For me, having my own plan for limited social contact that is really sustainable, I mean, I do feel like my social needs are being met right now in a limited way. I find myself way less likely to want to go out and have a spontaneous dinner party with other friends, or I feel less of a need to go out to a restaurant or a movie theater or any of these places that I might have been longing for if I was just trapped in my own apartment with one other person for months at a time.
I know a lot of people are talking about, even just with their partner at home, the need for socialization and really the need for their friends. And Christina, you wrote about how your quarantine bubble is made up of all queer friends, really your chosen family, and that queer people maybe understand best this need to look beyond your immediate family for support. So tell us more about that.
I think the concept of chosen family is a really natural and organic one for a lot of us. You know, whether it be because we are estranged from our families of birth, or just because we create community wherever we are. So we develop very close, you know, family-like relationships with people in our queer communities. We're also all very familiar with conversations that people have around non-monogamous relationships, around harm reduction and sex. We're all familiar with the history of HIV and AIDS. So the conversations that we have had around, you know, our tolerance for risk within our quarantine bubble, and generally trust, have felt very queer and very familiar to a lot of us from different areas of our lives. And in some ways, you know, I think those family-like relationships that we already have formed the basis of trust that made me feel comfortable joining a quarantine bubble. You know, as I've talked to other friends and coworkers about this, some people have said things like, well, you know, how do you trust that no one's going to pop the bubble and have a secret hangout with a friend or invite them over to their house? And I mean, I completely trust these people. I wouldn't have entered a bubble if I didn't feel that we were all sort of mutually committed to one another in this moment, and in a very important way, you know, when we're trying to prevent the spread of this virus that we know very little about.
Julia, I feel like I've been seeing on social media videos of people breaking social distancing rules. Maybe they're partying together or just large throngs of people in public spaces together. And I've been seeing a lot of kind of shaming happening on social media, but you say that shaming doesn't actually work in situations like this. Why not?
Well, I'm coming at this as an HIV prevention researcher, and we know that when we shame people for engaging in behavior that might increase their risk of HIV, let's say having condomless sex, then that behavior becomes stigmatized and people are afraid to disclose it. It doesn't actually stop the behavior. What it does is it pushes people away from disclosing that behavior, let's say, to a healthcare provider. And the result is that people don't end up getting the healthcare that they need. And you can imagine how that would play out right now. For example, we may shame people for gathering in a park, having a picnic, not wearing masks. And if we call them out on social media, they next time may not have that picnic, and instead they may take that socializing indoors where it actually becomes higher risk. And then you can also imagine that if there's an outbreak in that situation and contact tracers are trying to locate all the people who attended the event, those people may be hesitant to disclose that they were there. And essentially, shaming in the end doesn't have the effect that we want it to. It doesn't make the behavior go away. It drives it underground and it drives people away from accessing the public health services that they need.
I feel like we're talking a lot about balancing and assessing risks, but for some people, there are structural factors like systemic racism or poverty that take that decision-making around the risks completely out of your hands. Julia, how do you think public health officials could take that into account in their guidelines?
Considering context is a really important part of harm reduction. And one of the ways that it can help is that when we think about the context in which people make decisions about, let's say, social distancing, then we start to remember that they may not have total control over their situation. There may be context like depression because of isolation, but as you pointed out, there may also be structural factors like systemic racism that make it very difficult to social distance. And that's why people have been talking about social distancing being a privilege. We can also think about scenarios like the story of the hairdresser that was shared a couple days ago, who continued to work despite public health guidelines and ended up being linked to many new cases. And in that scenario, that hairdresser was shamed, but as an individual, he was making a decision in the context of needing a paycheck and not having enough social support or resources from the government to allow him to stay home and stop working. Mm-hmm. And when we blame that individual, we distract from where the accountability really lies, which is on the institutions that failed to support him. So when we come at this from a harm reduction approach, we keep that context front and center to avoid blaming the individual and also to remember where resources are actually needed.
You know, I'll be honest, I've been personally having a kind of hard time thinking about when I might be able to see my grandmothers again. They both live in different countries, different from each other as well. And I'm sure that many others are in a similar situation with older family members who live more than a car ride away. Julia, how can you navigate the risks when thinking about trying to see your family members who live far away?
I mean, certainly for somebody who is more local, we can think about low-risk ways to have a visit that might include being outdoors and remaining physically distant, mm-hmm. not sharing food, wearing masks. But then when you're talking about flying to see somebody, it becomes more complicated. I think in that scenario, ways to reduce risk would be to quarantine yourself for 2 weeks on either side of the trip and have the family that you're visiting do the same, and to be as careful as possible on the actual trip in terms of potential exposure at the airport or on the airplane.
Christina, has this come up in your quarantine bubble? Anyone wanting to visit others, especially elderly family members? I think that's when it really comes into play, wanting to break a rule or do it responsibly.
Yeah, we actually do have one couple in our bubble who are planning a visit to an older family member out in California. And in some ways, the fact that we have a bubble is making it a lot easier to plan a trip like that. You know, my wife and I are going to care for their dog. We're able to drive them to the airport so they don't have to take a Lyft or public transportation. And then we're starting conversations about what happens when they return from that trip. You know, will mm-hmm. they quarantine from our bubble? Will the rest of us see them, but you know, thoroughly limit our contact with the outside world even more than we're doing right now? But, you know, it helps to have other people to discuss those things with. You know, it's more people who can be doing research. It's more opinions and support that we can share with one another. But yeah, those questions aren't easy for anyone.
What about for people with children? I feel like I've been hearing from a lot of my parent friends that they are just wishing and dying to set up play dates for their kids, but they want to think about how to do that responsibly. Is there a way to consider it responsibly?
As a mom of two little kids who are 3 and 6, this is definitely at the front of my mind as well. Mm-hmm. I think with older kids, it's a bit easier because they may have an ability to understand that's 6 feet of distance. And I found that our kids really adapted very quickly to that norm. And now they police us. If we stand too close to someone, they say, "Mama, that's, you know, less than 6 feet." So I think it is possible to think about ways that you could maybe meet up in a park and have your kids kick a soccer ball around or go on a bike ride with another kid and a couple parents. And then another approach would be the one that Christina's taking, where you find another family that has kids the same age and decide to, you know, be a quarantine together. And those kids can then play together without that need for physical distancing. And again, it's not zero risk, but it is lower risk than, you know, your kids having a play date with different kids every few days.
And what about in general? I mean, what types of activities would you advise listeners to consider that could be low risk and could definitely satisfy that sense of socialization that people are missing?
I think the key here, at least for these next few months, is going to be being outdoors and keeping social interactions outdoors as much as possible. And of course, that's easier in some places that have more outdoor space than others, like really dense cities. But as much as cities can be thinking about opening up more outdoor space for people, I think that will help. And activities like walking with somebody, biking with someone, going on a run with someone, those are very low risk activities that can give people enough social contact that they feel sustained. And if people do want to get together in a group, try to keep that outdoors and try to maintain distance and try not to share food. Those are kind of, and of course, masks. All these same messages that we've been hearing for the last couple months still hold. But I think we have a better understanding now that transmission risk is much lower outdoors than it is indoors. And so that can help us think about ways that we can get some of that social contact, at least while the weather is pretty good over these next few months.
Christina, any last advice for people who might be listening and thinking, that sounds like a good idea. Maybe I should form my own quarantine bubble.
I would just say it's important to take into consideration what your lives are like before committing to a pod. I mean, we're all very lucky in that we have jobs that allow us to work from home. We don't have to take public transit to go to each other's houses, and none of us have any, indoor interaction with people who aren't in our pod. I know not everybody has that ability, which can make it hard if you have a group of friends with different jobs that require them to be working with a person in a very vulnerable community who might be at risk for extra complications from coronavirus. I also think it's important to have honest conversations about your own understanding of the risks of being in a pod and in your activities outside the pod. If we weren't all sort of on the same page in our desire to take very conservative precautions outside the pod, I don't think any of us would have wanted to commit to an exclusive household relationship with the others. But one of the best parts about it, if you are able to make it work, is the occasional ability to forget that the pandemic exists. The only time that I've really been able to do that has been when I've been, in somebody else's house, interacting with other people in a way that I otherwise haven't been able to for months now. And I can't overstate the psychic relief that I've gotten from that.
Julia Marcus is an infectious disease epidemiologist and an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School. And Christina Cotterucci is a writer for Slate Magazine. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
On Tuesday, the Justice Department informed three senators that it will no longer be investigating them for allegedly violating insider trading rules. Back in March, four senators were found to have sold stocks after private congressional briefings on the severity of the COVID-19 crisis. The four senators independently made millions of dollars from the sales. Although the investigation on Senators Feinstein, Inhofe, and Loeffler are ending, the DOJ will continue investigating Republican Senator Richard Burr. Joining us now is Max Kuttner, journalist covering the Justice Department. Max, it's great to have you back here.
Thank you.
So why is the federal government no longer investigating those three senators, Senators Feinstein, Inhofe, and Loeffler?
Well, we don't exactly know, Shumita, and this is typical. Typically, when people are not charged by the Justice Department, we don't even know there's a case against them, let alone the reasons why that case would have been dropped, even though some high-profile cases we have learned that information for. So it's likely we won't learn the reasons. The reasons, I think, are because of what they've said publicly, which is their defense. It was, we did not do these ourselves. These were our financial advisors. We had no part in the trading of these stocks. So it appears that the Justice Department probably bought that argument. And because Senator Richard Burr's argument was different, maybe that's why that case appears to be ongoing.
And what was Senator Burr's argument?
He argued that it wasn't that he didn't make the trades. It was that he did so with public information coming out of China, not information about the coronavirus that he gained from his role as a senator or from private briefings.
Have we seen anything like this in the past where senators engage in this type of action and potentially are not held responsible because they're able to say a financial advisor told me to do it?
Well, we have seen the issue of lawmakers and accusations of insider trading before. And until recently, it was thought that lawmakers were actually immune, thanks to the Constitution, for any insider trading, really, that had to do with their legislative roles. Now, in 2012, the Obama administration signed into law some legislation called the Stock Act that would try to close that loophole. And STOCK, that stands for Stop Trading on Congressional Knowledge Act. And what the legislation said was that a member of Congress or an employee of Congress can't use non-public information derived from their position as a means of making a private profit. And it specifically said this is meant to close the insider trading loophole. Now, that was in 2012, and it's been pretty untested since then. Only once was it enforced, and that was against a member of Congress who had information based on a specific company. So it's a bit different from what we're seeing now, where Senator Burr allegedly had this information more generally about the state of things, generally about the coronavirus, and not necessarily about a specific company. So that is likely going to be the rule that prosecutors are looking into. It's unclear if that will be enough to bring charges or even move forward and bring a conviction.
So what does this mean now for the other three senators? Are they just off the hook entirely?
Well, they've certainly been dusted up by this. It's interesting. I'm seeing a lot of chatter on Twitter today and yesterday since this news, basically taking the political sides. But you have people on one side saying this is another example of FBI malpractice and that they're dropping their case against Senator Feinstein, who's a Democrat. And then on the other side, you have Senator Loeffler, who's a Republican, saying this is she's calling this a left wing witch hunt. And so each side is kind of using this to push their cause when really, given that there was a Democrat and there were three Republicans, this is a kind of a bipartisan issue. But Kelly Loeffler does have a lot more to gain with the closure of this, as she is up for election in November. She's currently held holding a seat to which she was appointed by the governor. So the November election will be a special election. She's running against Republican Representative Doug Collins, who is an ally of President Trump's. He got a lot of airtime during the impeachment hearings as ranking member of the House Judiciary Committee. And polls show that he is right now in the lead. So Loeffler has a lot more to gain by going on TV, as she's been doing the past 24 hours, and saying, these charges were dropped against me. Let's move forward from this.
And what about for Senator Burr? Could you sort of walk us through maybe the range of repercussions he may be facing?
Sure. So the case against Burr is said to be ongoing. He had to step down temporarily from the Senate Intelligence Committee. This is a major committee. This is one of the committees that's been investigating Russia. And as recently as the day that he stepped down, even released its even had some news on its Russia investigation, said it had finished the Russia investigation and was now awaiting clearance on the final volume of its report. So that hasn't even come out yet. He's also self-reported to the Senate Ethics Committee, so they are presumably looking into this. And he was said to be retiring in 2022, not too long from now. So if this is kind of how he ends his career, that's not a great thing from him. He's had a very long career. So he would also have a lot to gain from this going away. But the investigation is ongoing, and time will tell if prosecutors buy his defense so far, and if the Senate Ethics Committee buys his defense so far, that, again, he made these decisions based on public information, not information he derived from his role as a senator.
Is there any possibility that the investigation into Burr could reopen an investigation into the other three senators?
Anything is possible, Shumita, but that seems unlikely. It does seem that, given that they were cleared pretty quickly, those other three senators, and it didn't even escalate to charges, let alone moving forward with a case against them, it seems unlikely that they have much to worry about moving forward.
Max Kuttner is a journalist covering the Justice Department. Max, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
By now, you've probably seen or heard about the viral video showing Christian Cooper, a black man, being threatened by a white woman, Amy Cooper, no relation, while he was birdwatching in Central Park.
I'm going to tell them there's an African-American man threatening my life.
In the video, Christian asks her to leash her dog in a popular birdwatching destination called The Ramble, where dogs are required to be leashed at all times. Instead of leashing her dog, Amy calls the police on him, falsely accusing him of threatening her life. The incident raises a lot of questions, including about who can safely engage with nature in certain spaces. Drew Lanham is a professor of wildlife ecology at Clemson University. He's been birdwatching since he was 5 or 6 years old.
Well, it was nature and nurture for me. It was growing up in rural South Carolina, Edgefield, South Carolina, on a family farm, and having birds really as constant companions and marveling over their flight.
As a black man, Drew has spent years navigating the overwhelmingly white space that is birdwatching. And a warning that this conversation contains strong language that some listeners may find offensive.
The best way to put it, it's one of the whitest hobbies that you can have. And I've navigated it most recently, I suppose, with lots of friends who may not share my skin color, but who share a passion for birds. And so there's this transcendent sort of nature of loving birds that's helped me to navigate pretty serious social issues. I think about those epic migratory journeys. I think about their ranges and what it takes to be a bird, to weigh no more than a handful of paper clips, to fly thousands of miles, to sing your songs uninhibited. There's something to admire in that. But then I'm pulled back into realities of unarmed people, black people being killed. And it makes me wonder if I'm safe in my backyard doing what I'm doing. And the most recent episode with Christian Cooper in Central Park took me back to almost exactly a year ago when I was in New York City, I believe, and talking at the American Museum of Natural History about inclusion, diversity, and conservation, and having a walk in the park. We were in a place where it wasn't a big deal, apparently, or it didn't seem, to see black men, three black men birding. Now, come full circle with all that's happening in the world, it makes the navigation tricky. The news stream tells me that there's another reality out there that I have to cope with. So I'm sort of constantly back and forth and back and forth.
Have you yourself had to confront racism while out birdwatching?
Yeah, I have. And it's funny, it's not something I really recognized, I think, until I was much older, probably in my late 20s, early 30s. I began to wonder where the others were that looked like me, who must love birds as much as I did. So I became aware of the potential for danger out there, that there were places, for example, in Western North Carolina, where there were encampments of racists who were literally targeting black people. It wasn't the direct contact, it was the possibility of it. And so I've always been keenly aware of maps, of ranges, of racists, of where they are, of Confederate flags, of places where people suddenly call their homeland as separatist, and that they should be there and no one else should be there. And so that was really one of my first realities, I think, in that quagmire that racism is, and it sort of pulls you down mentally, but directly, more recently, having an encounter with someone who considered the good old days the days of niggers picking cotton. Mm. And having this very odd, I won't even call a conversation, but this listening and sitting and hearing someone referring to me, to black people as that, was again, sort of a grounding. It was this fall from flight, but as a black American, I think you sort of steel yourself. You learn to expect, unfortunately, these incidents. Some of them are microaggressions most people would not recognize. Others are macroaggressions. Like I said, when I see Confederate flags, it gives me pause. When I see certain other flags, it gives me pause. to go into places. So it's a daily thing.
You know, Drew, you speak with such joy and reverence about bird watching, and yet you also talk about the distracting thoughts, particularly because you are a Black man who does bird watching. I mean, does it distract at all from what you're setting out to do when you go out?
Yeah, in some ways, there are places that I won't go. I mean, again, I talk about ranges and range maps, and I have a range map just like birds have a range map. And I have my own sort of, rather than a field guide, I have a feel guide, and I feel my way forward. And feeling your way forward is a tough way to go sometimes when you want to follow wild and free things. If you're inhibited in some way, if you know there's a place where you shouldn't go, or if there are markers like those flags that tell you, you know what, you might not be welcome here. Or if there's a history, really, that's been passed down of a sundown town, or if there's something in the news that has alerted you to the potential for danger, or if there's a lingering look in a neighborhood when you're chasing some rarity and you know that maybe that neighborhood isn't so diverse and people would recognize you as being out of your place. You know, the Ahmaud Arbery, that story hit hard for all of us in many different ways, but I couldn't help but think about times that I've been in neighborhoods that weren't my neighborhood, walking around mostly with friends, but on occasion or two alone looking for some bird. And I'm sure I was being watched because I wasn't supposed to be there, or being stopped by the police who saw me in a place and said, well, you look like a suspect, and being detained on my own campus. Those are sort of these constant things, yes, that distract. We develop, I think, and when I say we, I mean Black folks, I think we develop this sixth and seventh sense that's adaptive, that helps you understand, you know, this is a place that you should be, this is a place that you shouldn't be, or maybe this is a place you can drive by and look but don't get out. You know, maybe this is a place that you go with a white friend. And sometimes that's the advice that I've given other friends. I've said, you know, if you're going to go in that neighborhood, why don't you call a white birder friend to go with you? And they can serve as a buffer or a guide, because Black people walking around with binoculars or spotting scopes might not be accepted so readily in some places.
Drew, you've written about the parallels you see between the experience of birds and marginalized communities. You've written about this in Audubon magazine. Can you explain what you mean by that?
It's part of my bird-brainedness to see my life through a bird's life, and to see that struggle that birds experience and all that they have to overcome. A single hooded warbler, for example, to have traveled from Central America to made some leap across the Gulf of Mexico in a nonstop flight, and then to reach the Gulf shores, and then to work its way through swamps and forests and woodlots over developed lands where it cannot land, to be in my presence. And it's made that epic journey. If everything goes right, it has not had to endure some of the things that humans have done, but more than likely it's had to dodge not only natural predators, but things like outdoor cats. It may have had to dodge buildings. It may have had to fly through skies that are lit up. And so the human equivalent of that, I think, is what we often face on a daily basis, that there are barriers that each of us, no matter what color, faces on a daily basis, things that we go through. No life is without trial, but there are these tribulations of success that we can experience. But then when there are other barriers that are put up, when you're already dealing with issues, and then out of nowhere comes this predatory strike of prejudice, then there you are. You're trying to make your way to someplace just as that bird is, but there's something that's come and that's interrupted you. It's interrupted your day. It's thrown you off your flight path. And suddenly you're misplaced. You're displaced. You're a bird that's out of habitat. You're out of your norm, and you've got to reset. And that reset takes energy. And on a daily basis, to have to spend your energy, not just being you, but wondering why somebody hates you for being you. When I was watching this hooded warbler the other day and was amazed at the song that this bird was singing, and I'm looking at its plumage, this wonderful olive-backed, lemon-yellow-breasted bird with a yellow face that's encircled, the male's face's yellow face is encircled by this black hood. This bird was singing on territory, and I'm watching it and absorbing it, but had in my mind as I was watching it that this bird could wear its hood without trepidation, without profiling, without having to worry about someone killing it just because it's a hooded warbler. And I really thought that. I my mind went there. At the same time as I was loving this bird and relishing my time alone with it, there was nothing else in the world at that time. There was this other part of me that was thinking, huh, what would it be like to be a bird and have that actual freedom of no judgment, of no suspicion? That's my feather-fascinated life, I guess you would say.
What is your favorite bird?
My favorite bird is the one with feathers.
I'm sure it's unfair to ask what your favorite one
well,
is.
Well, no, it's fun to think about. I have lists of birds that I love. Right now, probably if I were pressed, it'd probably be the loggerhead shrike, which is a songbird that's in rapid decline. But it's a songbird that has habits that some people don't like. It eats small mammals and songbirds, but it impales them on thorns because its feet are too weak.
Oh, wow.
But it is a songbird. And so it's involved in sort of this ecological code switching, which people of color spend a lot of time doing, sort of switching between one persona and the other.
That's right.
That's my favorite bird for right now, if I have to name one, but writ large, it's the one with feathers.
Drew, I want to ask you to explain that a little bit further, code switching from a bird's perspective and code switching from your human perspective. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, there's this personality that we all have, our base of who we are. It's your psychic clothes, your psychological vestments, as it were, that when you go out to a business meeting, you know, you're wearing a collared shirt, you're wearing certain things, and you have a certain comportment. Your behavior is at a certain level. Well, what's the first thing that most of us do when we get back home? We can't wait to get into our sweatpants and a t-shirt and kick off the shoes, and we kick up our feet, and we are not worried so much about proper comportment. That's a kind of code switching culturally.
That's like cultural code switching.
Yeah, cultural code switching, and you know, which goes a little deeper in how we might speak or whether or not we use certain colloquialisms when we're out and when we get back home, or whether, you know, I decide to relax and maybe my voice gets a little more southern than it usually is, or, you know, it's those things that and then we're all sort of chameleons in that way. For birds, that code switching goes not so much into who the bird is. I always tell my birder friends, don't be worried about misidentifying a bird because they know who they are.
I like that.
A loggerhead shrike does what it does. It is who it is as a bird. But the code switching comes in when we perceive the bird, when we make judgment calls on the bird because of behavior, just as it does with humans. So the old name for the loggerhead shrike is butcher bird, and they were seen as being injurious to other birds. You look at some of the old texts and they will talk about protecting most birds, but killing hawks, owls, and shrikes were considered raptorial, in that they would sometimes kill other songbirds. And so here's a bird that has a life as a songbird, that it lives, but humans place it in another category. And so that's a, to me, that's sort of this cultural code switching externally of expectation. I see so many birds sort of in these double-sided mirrors, and I see them for the wonderful ecological beings that they are. And I try to understand that as an observer and a scientist, to not judge their behavior, but then to study how we have defined these birds because of that behavior, that we've put them, that we've bracketed them into categories of acceptable and not acceptable, of a good bird and a bad bird. That's something that that interests me greatly, and I think it impacts how birds are conserved.
What can the bird watching community do to be more inclusive?
There's some great folks out there that are really trying to solve that problem, or at least address it. I don't want to lay all of the responsibility on the bird watching community, but I want to lay the onus on bird watchers as people who, many care about birds, not just to count them or list them, but to conserve them. And to conserve means to care with some intensity, so that you save some for others. It's supposed to be a selfless act, and so there's love involved. And if there's love involved for a wild thing who desires and needs the same air, the same water, the same soil, this same healthy earth that hopefully we're striving for, then bird watchers can be on board for that. And part of that is social justice, and part of that is paying attention, taking the binoculars down, and seeing around you and recognizing that things might be different, recognizing that you're in a monolith, and that if you're going to go forward, if we're going to go forward in a way to help protect the earth, to help protect birds wherever, in Central Park or Saskatchewan or South Carolina, that ultimately it comes down to us joining together in a way and recognizing the fates are tied together with birds, that birds have always been our guides, our sort of signatories for the environment. We have to pay attention, not just to the birds that we see through binoculars, but we have to pay attention to what's beyond those binoculars, to what's in the periphery. I'm always struck when we'll go into an impoverished area to see some rare bird, tick it off the list, and we're carrying optics that represent a large fraction of the per capita income, but we leave with only those birds on our list, but we've left nothing better for those communities behind. And so I would like to see the birding community, individuals and organizations, really be use this opportunity and all this conversation that we're having, Shamita, to be not just inclusive, not just count diversity, but to be intensely intentional about inclusion, to call out the wrong when you see it, to not just film it, to not just be a stander by, to not just be an observer, to not just say I'm sorry, to not just be mad about it, but to do something about it, to talk to your friends. For I think the big moves now really are, quite frankly, for white people to talk to white people and to say, we can't tolerate this. I think back to my parents in the civil rights movement, and I think about it. And the civil rights movement wasn't just about black rights. It was about everyone's rights. And I think now is the time for a new kind of movement, and for feeling, thinking, knowing people to step forward in ways that they may not have before. And sometimes maybe to engage peacefully but forcefully, but then to disengage. I don't have any room in my life or my my social media pages for people who would excuse the kinds of behavior that we've just seen. I don't have that space in my head or my heart to carry along hate. That's what I would like in my world. I would like for people to see birds and be transcended through them, to understand that this world can be better for all of us, but we have to make moves, and we have to make those moves now.
Drew Lanham is an avid bird watcher and a professor of wildlife ecology at Clemson University. We're going to continue our conversation about the racist incident in Central Park by stepping back from birdwatching and talking more about, quote, white spaces in general and how Black people are expected to navigate them. Joining me is Mickey Kendall, feminist writer and the author of the book Hood Feminism, Notes from the Women That a Movement Forgot. When Mickey first saw the Central Park video, she said it was hard to process what exactly she was seeing on the screen.
Because what you're seeing is somebody lie and build the lie coldly in front of you, right? So she's not in danger. He asks her to back up. You can see that this is not really a scary situation. So it's very disconcerting to see her behave verbally, not physically, but verbally, as though she's somehow scared or upset, but physically be the aggressor. And then as she's using her words, for lack of a better way to put it, building a narrative that is a threat, all while feigning fear, right? We're supposed to think she's scared, but the video shows us she's not afraid. She approaches him and gets belligerent with him. And when she tells him that she's going to call and say it's an African-American man, and you watch her voice go from angry to teary, and it's completely fake, it's such a disturbing sequence to watch. Like, my first thought was, what is this? Is this staged? And then I realized it wasn't staged. And then trying to follow the pattern in her head that made her think the video camera in front of her wouldn't reveal what she was doing.
Yeah, Mickey, I actually want to play for our listeners, if they haven't heard, exactly what you're talking about, the tone and the inflection of Amy Cooper's voice and how that changed during the video. Let's listen.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you either. I'm being threatened by a man into the Ramble. Please send the cops immediately. I'm in Central Park in the Ramble. I don't know.
So that's Amy Cooper, and there was a lot of public outcry on social media about this incident caught on camera. But I was also struck by some of the ways that people were defending her actions. Were you seeing those types of defenses? What were your reactions to that?
So it was an interesting lesson in how implicit bias makes people see what they're most comfortable with. So people said, well, we don't know how her day started. We don't know, you know, maybe she was having a bad day. You watch someone across a sequence of minutes make decisions, choices, go from calm to upset, well, really calm to rage, and then to fake fear. We watched her do all of these things, but people were saying, well, maybe she didn't mean for him to get hurt, but she told you she did. She told you when she said, I'm going to tell them it's an African-American male.
Yeah, and there is a long history, of course, of white women accusing, falsely accusing Black men of crimes. And I'm thinking of everything from Emmett Till to more recent examples like this one. How does this incident compare to other situations where white women weaponize their tears against Black people?
So the good news is that Christian Cooper was not injured. He was not arrested or harassed. Mm-hmm. The bad news is that this was a fluke. He's an outlier more often than not. And we can talk about Susan Smith, or we can talk about John Crawford, the third in Ohio, who was shot in a Walmart because of someone's false call. We can talk about, you know, Amber Geiger, who breaks into someone's house and shoots them, all of these things. More often than not, this ends in some kind of harm, whether it be an arrest and the person who didn't commit a crime being harassed by police or abused by police or losing some part of their livelihood or their good name, or worse, someone ending up dead, right? Even as we watch this playing out, in Minnesota, we saw the police kneel on a man's neck until he mm-hmm. was dead, right? There's no guns involved because someone said, well, no one came with guns. Well, you don't need a gun to kill a man. You don't need a gun to kill a woman. And this history, even though I know Christian Cooper has since said that he didn't want her life to be torn apart, it's about Christian Cooper, but it's not really about Christian Cooper. It's about all of the people who can be hurt by this, right? We've seen no reports, and hopefully the police just didn't respond aggressively. But imagine if that entire scene had played out differently. And let's say Christian Cooper continued his birding, but 4, 5, 7, 10 other people who fit her description, which is a black man in a bicycle helmet, were then stopped and accosted by police, were abused by police. Because let's be clear, if you Google NYPD and brutality, the record is there. She knows exactly where she lives. She knows exactly what she's doing.
You know, it makes me think also about who can and who can't weaponize law enforcement to their advantage. And I understand the answer here might be obvious, but what does it tell you that she decided in that moment to call the police?
The polite way to put this is that she relied on the state to do exactly what the state had always done, serve the interest of white supremacy. That was what she felt was necessary in the moment because someone had dared to challenge her internal narrative about her right to do whatever she wanted, however she wanted. Let's be clear here. She knew she could call the police and that they would do this thing. And she includes this threat to mention he's an African-American male and all of this because she's comfortable. She never has to fear the police. She's never been afraid of the cops. And that says a lot about what policing really is in America and its purpose. If you're going to argue that we need the police, who's the we? Mm-hmm. Who are they protecting? Who are they serving? Whose interests are they handling? Because let's be clear, this was about putting a leash on a dog, obeying the posted signs.
Right.
And she was willing to risk his life so she didn't have to put a leash on a dog.
Now, on Monday, Amy Cooper, this white woman, told NBC New York, quote, "I sincerely and humbly apologize to everyone, especially to that man, his family." What did you make of Amy Cooper's apology?
That wasn't an apology.
Why not?
That was Amy Cooper absolving or attempting to absolve herself before the consequences showed up. Mm. Because by that point, we knew his name. So that man, we can't apologize to. I apologize to Mr. Cooper. Secondly, to anyone I might have offended, you didn't just offend someone. You filed a false police report. You knowingly, willfully chose to file a false police report. And aside from the fact that it's apparently a crime in New York, you did so in such a way as to guarantee in your head he would be punished for daring to tell you to obey the law.
Mm.
So sure, she's sorry she got caught. She's sorry that the video went viral. I'll believe that. Is she sorry for her behavior? I have a much more difficult time because part of that apology was, I'm not racist. But you just weaponized race on video. So yes, you are racist.
Let's talk about that because as people have continued to look into this woman, Amy Cooper, some have pointed out that she's donated to recent Democratic candidates. She donated to President Obama's campaign. And some, it seems, are seeing that as a sort of cognitive dissonance, like this idea that Amy Cooper might actually identify as a liberal. What does this tell you about the white liberal identity?
I wouldn't necessarily say that she would identify as a liberal. I would say that there's a wide gap between Tea Party conservatives and literally the entire rest of the political spectrum. And so for a lot of people who I donated to Obama, it's because they didn't like his opponent. Let's start there. Then let's also talk about the fact that being quote unquote liberal throughout American history, especially in terms of white liberal politics, has never meant that you were not racist. You know, like we have a narrative that Lincoln freed the slaves. Well, A, he didn't. And B, are we really going to say he's liberal because he didn't want to keep an institution going that he already knew was going to fail? And especially when we know that his plan was then to deport everyone of color, everyone who had been a former slave. So it's not that we have this binary of either you are liberal and not racist or you are conservative and racist. It's like everything else, a spectrum. Sure, she may not be. I will burn a cross on your lawn, racist. She apparently is. I will file a false police report with NYPD, racist.
This incident took place in an area in Central Park, which is very popular with bird watchers, which, as we've just been discussing, is an overwhelmingly white space. How are people of color, especially Black people, expected to navigate these types of white spaces?
So one of the interesting things is that you can tell that she doesn't think he has a right to be there, or that he doesn't have as much of a right as she does. Mm. But in those spaces, you're somehow both supposed to be glad to be present and then defer, I guess, to whiteness. But the reality is that if we're in this world where everyone is equal and racism doesn't exist and post-racial and all the things, then everyone has a right to be everywhere. But the expectation is that somehow we accept that white people have more of a right and that they get to direct their attention to who else is there in a way as though I own this space and you have to prove your right to be here. Mm. You have to justify your presence. Right. So when we're talking about predominantly white spaces, there's some idea that white people get to police who is present, regardless of whether or not they own that space or have any inherent right to control who enters that space, and that Black people are supposed to accept it, that other people of color are supposed to accept it, but especially Black people and especially Black men.
I'm thinking about in the aftermath of incidents like this, the emotional burden often falls on Black people. What are your suggestions for how white people can better shoulder that burden and take on some of the very necessary conversations that need to take place?
I think in some very important ways, we have to be teaching white people in particular, in general, as a society, America has to start teaching anti-racism, not just as a general, don't be like the Klan, but as in a very specific, direct, and using examples like this, right? Don't be a Karen. Don't think you own the space or the right to access to a space that you don't. We kind of have to teach not to be racist, not to think you have more validity as a person than someone else because of the color of their skin. And we have to start that not at the high school or college or whatever we're currently arguing is old enough to learn about race. Black children have to learn about racism before they're even born. They experience it before they're born. They have to deal with it in the hospital. They have to deal with it when they go home. Their families have to deal with it. Mm. So should white children. They should be dealing with race and racism at the same rate as everyone who experiences it.
Mikki Kendall is a feminist writer and author of the books Hood Feminism and Amazon's Abolitionists and Activists. Mikki, thank you so much for coming back on the show.
Thank you for having me again.
We're going to end the hour by hearing from comedian Tawny Newsome. Tawny is prolific within the comedy podcasting world, and recently she's been picking up increasingly high-profile acting jobs. The last project that Tawny filmed before lockdowns went into effect in the U.S. was an episode of Jordan Peele's The Twilight Zone.
It was so surreal to be filming an episode of The Twilight Zone amidst a blossoming global pandemic. I played a surgeon, so literally my last scene that I filmed was me scrubbing in for surgery. So it's just different angles of me washing my hands while I'm thinking about how I just have to get off this set full of 100 people and immediately wash my
Whoa.
Hands again.
It may be some time before Tawny is back on a film set, but this week you can find her starring alongside Steve Carell and John Malkovich in Netflix's Space Force. Loosely inspired by the real-life military branch formed under President Trump, Space Force was created by Greg Daniels, who's best known for making the American version of The Office. Tawny's character, Angela Ali, is a pilot who takes her role within the Space Force very seriously.
Hey, you two, get back here. Now. Yeah, you said something disrespectful to my guest, so you're gonna take a little run. East launch pad.
That's very far, ma'am.
And back.
That's almost twice as far, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am, right away. Running now.
And Tawny told me that while she was preparing for the show, she took her research seriously as well.
Angela makes it to officer. She ends up transferring in. Even though she was previously enlisted, she's mm-hmm. an officer now. So she is ascending the ranks. And I really, like, I started scoping out and looking for Black women, especially who are officers in different branches of the military. I started looking for pilots, Black women pilots from, you know, all over, just because I wanted to surround myself with images of that. I mean, that's kind of the definition of why representation matters, right? If you can see it, then you can imagine yourself doing it, mm-hmm. both from a little girl thinking about a career standpoint and also as an actor, me looking at all of these Marines and Army soldiers and other women gave me ideas about hairstyles. Like, one thing that was really important to me and to our military advisor and everyone on set was that, you know, I wore my hair appropriate for a person in uniform.
Sure.
I have really big, curly hair that is everywhere and it's hard to manage. And I was really weighing the challenges that a lot of enlisted women and women, service women face when they're trying to figure out, okay, how do we stick within the military ranks? Do we smooth it down? Do we straighten it? And, you know, just over a year ago, the armed services approved braids and locks as approved styles. Mm-hmm. So I was like, oh, this would be a genius way to honor a lot of those women who probably were waiting to get to wear their hair in braids for years and years. So
Sure. That's
just a small way that, yeah, we were trying to honor the reality of these exact people.
Now, you also co-host a podcast called Yo, Is This Racist? With Andrew T. It sort of sounds like it's a racism helpline. People call in and leave you a voicemail and ask, is this racist? Or how should I feel about this? What's it been like to transition into doing this podcast from home?
Well, I love doing things from home. I mean, I'm a lifelong musician too, so I always have mm-hmm. a little studio set up, so that part hasn't been hard. I do want to make sure people know that we're not a real helpline. Like, we are primarily comedians.
Sure.
And we love to have like a third perspective of another comedian or writer or person in entertainment, usually who's a person of color, but not always. And we just have free-flowing discussions about the things people call in for. So sometimes people call in with really serious stuff that we're like, I don't know if I'm the one qualified for you to talk to.
I like when you end up asking each other, did we help this person? Was this the right answer?
We often did not. Sometimes I'm just like, you need a newspaper. I don't know. Mm-hmm, I don't know mm-hmm. what to do for you.
I want to talk a little bit more about your comedy career. And I know that you were at Second City when you lived in Chicago. You've also performed with your band, John Langford's Four Lost Souls, at music venues. How are you feeling about the future of live comedy and live music right now?
I mean, I'm legitimately worried. I'm hopeful, but I'm nervous. You know, I spent a lot of years making my primary living as a live performing comedian and musician. I would trade, you know, I'd go for a month on tour with a band, then I'd come back and do 6 weeks of a scripted sit-down comedy show in Rochester, New York, or something with the Second City. So it was what got me out of waiting tables, which is something that a lot of people can't say, that live performing became their bread and butter. That is, it's hard to do, and it was hard to maintain even then. I don't know how independent venues are going to stay open. I've been trying to support venues that I've had good memories at, just, you know, like looking to see if they have a GoFundMe page or buying merchandise from them if they're selling t-shirts or something. Mm-hmm. But I'm legitimately scared, and I'm kind of scared of the corporatization that's going to take over of some of these small venues. Because if you're an indie rock club in Arlington and you suddenly can't open back up, who's gonna buy that space, and what type of bands are they gonna book, and what type of content are they gonna put up? I think the preservation of the indie music and comedy spaces is one of the most important things that we have for allowing new art to flourish.
And in terms of acting, how do you feel about the idea of returning to a film set after all this and picking up where some of your productions have had to pause?
I feel very lucky to be in the job that I'm in, because even if people wanted to go back to work prematurely, even if certain productions wanted to, I am encouraged by the fact that this is, you know, this industry is billions and billions of dollars, and there are so many people that it takes to make a film set. And I keep joking that being an actor on a film set is just 12 hours of someone touching your face. So there is, I have to have faith.
That sounds very unideal right now.
Right now, it's just like different strangers coming up, putting a microphone on your collarbone, mm-hmm. someone adjusting your eyebrow. It's a COVID nightmare. So I am emboldened by the fact that these very, very expensive productions are not going to rush back in because, you know, if someone gets sick, it's a very visible industry. It's a very litigious world we're in. It would seem wild to me that any production would go back prematurely. And I don't think they'll do it purely, if not for the people's sake, definitely because there's too much money on the line.
You know, I try not to read people's quotes back to them from past interviews, but I'm going to make an exception this time because
what
maybe it'll be a nice point
do?
Of reflection. No. So here's what it is. In 2017, you gave an interview to Vulture and you expressed some frustration at the time with the roles that you'd been getting. And you'd said, it can be hard to find a place right now. So I think I just need to create that place myself. Do you feel like you're at a point in your career now where you've been able to carve out your own space?
Yeah. You know, what's interesting is that like this role in Space Force was one of those perfect marriages of collaboration. There was a great pilot script. The script was so lovely that I cornily told the casting director, Allison Jones, after my first audition. I was just like, I just love this script. Even if I don't get cast, I just want you to know. And she was like, cool story. That's great. But I do feel like this is the start of that for me because Greg Daniels is such a great collaborator and his door is so open to ideas about the character that between me and him and the writers and Steve, like we have created this character together and I feel like an active participant in shaping her. This whole last season, I felt like I was asked for my input and trusted when I disagreed about things. And it was a really good way to create it. So if that's, you know, halfway to making my own stuff, I feel like the next piece of it is right around the corner.
Tawny Newsome is a comedian and one of the stars of Netflix's Space Force, which is coming out later this week. Thank you so much, Tawny.
Thank you. This was great.
We've been checking in with a bunch of different comedians on The Takeaway, including Samantha Bee and Roy Wood Jr., since the coronavirus outbreak started. You can find all of those conversations online at thetakeaway.org/jokingfromadistance. That's all for me on The Takeaway. It has been such a pleasure filling in for Tanzina Vega all this month. Great news, she'll be back in the hosting chair on Monday. I know I'll be listening. I hope you will too. And Amy Walter is in tomorrow as usual. Our board operator, Debbie Daughtry, was in the studio at WNYC for us alongside Vince Fairchild, who was our director this week. Working from home was line producer Jackie Martin and editor Jay Cowett in the mornings. Alexandra Boti is our senior producer. Our producers are Ethan Oberman, Jose Olivares, Meg Dalton, Jason Tureski, and Lydia McMullen Laird. Amber Hall and Patricia Jacob are our politics producers. Polly Arungu is our digital editor. Katerina Barton is our intern, and David Gable is our executive assistant. Lee Hill is our executive producer, and I'm Shamitha Basu. You can find me on Twitter at ShuBasu. That's ShuBasu. You'll also find my contact information there. And that's all for now. I'll be a listener like you next week. And always, be well. This is The Takeaway.